Gwen Florio, in what ways are you impossible to control?
What a great question. I'm sure my family would tell you in every single way. The reason I'm laughing at this question is because it's a central part of this book. And I didn't think about maybe the fact that I put myself into some of the characters here.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Gwen Florio about her novel, Silent Hearts. The story weaves together an encounter between two women in Afghanistan, an American aid worker named Leave and a local interpreter, Farida. In the book, their lives unfold against the difficult themes of war, oppression of women, and moments of connection and disconnection in marriage. We'll begin by hearing Gwen read a scene, which takes place one September morning as Leave and her husband Martin wake up in their Philadelphia home. I want to circle back to this central part of the book, but first, I just want you to lead us in by reading a bit.
Okay. Leave rose late and unsettled. She blamed scheduling. Martin taught afternoon classes on Tuesdays, and she was working from home while shepherding a particularly demanding project, along with the torpor of a September morning. After 15 years in the Philadelphia suburbs, the cloaking dampness of the heat still surprised Leave, who never stopped missing the searing but mercifully brief season in her native Minnesota. It was almost 9. Coffee. She needed coffee. She poured herself a bowl of cereal so lacking in taste that it made her believe its claim of healthfulness, and through force of habit, turned on the television. She muted the sound, mindful of Martin, who was still sleeping. The coffee maker, set up the night before, hissed and burbled to fragrant life. She set the cereal aside, filled her mug, and welcomed functionality back into her synapses. Steam wreathed her face. Sweat pricked her hairline. She turned to the television. A red banner at the bottom of the screen announced breaking news. The anchor leaned toward the camera. Deep furrows plowed his forehead. Leave, her vision still sleep-blurred, squinted over the rim of her mug. The scene switched to a video of inky smoke plumed from a gashed skyscraper. The words on the banner came into focus. The mug slipped from Leave's fingers and shattered against the tile. Coffee scalded her bare feet. She registered the fact of pain, of the jagged bits of porcelain, of the need to step carefully. Too late. She tracked blood down the hallway to the bedroom, grabbed at Martin, and shook him. "What the hell, Leave?" He glanced down. "Are you all right? What happened to your foot?" "Come, now, something's wrong. Not with me, maybe with air traffic control." She fled back down the hall. The breached hall of the Pentagon filled the screen. Martin, safe in slippers, kicked mug shards aside and folded her in his arms. "Nothing's wrong with air traffic control. We're under attack."
What I found interesting, Gwen, about the book is that the tension takes place after the events of 9/11, yet the book press doesn't explicitly capitalize on that. And I was wondering if that was intentional.
Yeah. You know, 9/11 obviously is what launched everything that happens in this book. And I wanted to touch on it, but move quickly beyond to the aftermath.
The book is instead billed as a story between two women, an aid worker and an interpreter. And the book really highlights dynamics between men and women, specifically within an American marriage and a Pakistani-Afghani marriage. And you write from the perspective of the Afghani husband about his new Pakistani wife. And the husband's name is Ghul. And he says, "She would be more than just difficult to control. She would be impossible." Why is Farida difficult to control? And what does it mean in this culture to have a wife like Farida?
Sure. Farida has her, you know, she's educated. She works. She's an interpreter. She speaks several languages. And the idea there in both Pakistan and Afghanistan is that basically, you know, the husband's the one in control. Over and over again, women there would ask me in both places, "Do you have a cooperative husband?" And I was just fascinated by that question. I'm like, "Well, that sounds wonderful, but what is it?" if your husband agreed, you could do anything. You could work. You could, in Pakistan, a few women drove, which is very unusual. You know, you could go to school. You could teach. You could run a business if your husband supported that. And so you met these incredibly independent and strong women who did all of these things with the support of their husbands. But that was the key part.
That's right. You went overseas after 9/11, both to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. What was your role?
I was a reporter for the Denver Post at the time.
And did you speak to women?
I did. That was one of the great things about being a woman there, and especially in Afghanistan, which was way more conservative. In Pakistan, I was in Islamabad and Peshawar, which is a little more conservative. And then Afghanistan was radically more conservative. So men really couldn't talk to women, but I could.
When I was reading the book, knowing this about your history, Leave is the American aid worker. Mm-hmm. And I kept sort of trying to read your experience maybe onto her or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the book where Leave is getting prepared to go overseas and learning how to use a generator and learning right. how to staunch wounds. Mm-hmm. Did you have to go through that kind of training?
Not before I went to Afghanistan, and I should have. And luckily, I did not have to use a generator there. We kind of poached other people's. We would trade candy bars and things for hits of generators to juice up our gear. But before I went to Iraq, I went to what I called war camp, where they told you exactly those things. I think I put some of it in the book. One of the things I remember is never push intestines back in.
That's right. That line really stuck out to me, as well as this line, think of the headlamp as a talisman. If you've got it on, nothing will happen.
And that's kind of my own interpretation. At this moment, I have a headlamp in my purse.
I love it.
And exactly for that reason. But you always wanted to have one on you because the electricity was always going out. You know, you could be, and this happened in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you'd be going up 5 or 6 flights of a dark black hotel stairwell. And, you know, you'd hear other people in there, but you couldn't see anybody. So, yeah, that headlamp was key. And also, as a practical matter, if you're typing, you want the headlamp. You don't want to be holding a flashlight in your teeth.
That sounds like expensive dental work.
Yeah.
Can you speak to the differences within mistreatment of women in Afghanistan versus America? In specific, you write about the cruelty towards wives.
Yeah, and that's something I really wanted to highlight and explore in the book. The mistreatment of Afghani women is so obvious. Some of the laws and everything that govern them, although I did see great kindnesses within marriages there. What fascinated me is what if you took an American man and put him in a culture where it's not only permissible, but in some ways encouraged to be very cruel to women, how might he react given that kind of permission?
And who we're talking about is Martin. Dear sweet Martin,
yeah.
The American man, can you deepen his character for me? Because he comes across as sort of a buffoon and lecherous. And I mean, he's trying to do good academic work, maybe.
I tried hard to soften Martin, to take off some of his rough edges. And part of what explains his personality is that he feels really stymied. He had specialized in Central Asian studies when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, and it was a hot topic. Then it kind of fell off the radar after the Soviets left, and he's marooned in this backwater college, and all of his colleagues are passing him by, and he's frustrated and firmly in midlife crisis. And here comes this golden opportunity that lets him bring all of his expertise back to the forefront. And that's about as charitable as I can be toward Martin. Somebody had to be the bad guy.
You dipped your toe into this occupation of mm-hmm. foreign countries. And one of the history lessons that I learned that I wasn't aware of mm-hmm. was Soviet rule. Mm-hmm. Why was it important to you to cover, you know, Russian occupation?
In some ways, that occupation was better for women.
Say more.
Yeah, the Soviets encouraged equality in ways that vanished the minute they were kicked out. And of course, when the Taliban came to power, then things really just became even more horrible. Several women said when the Soviets were here, we had it better. And again, that would apply only to the cities. The countryside pretty much has been the same forever. Basically, what the Taliban did is they took mores and practices in effect in the countryside and imposed them on the whole country.
I'm thinking about your main character, Farida, and she spent some time in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me about writing her as a little bit of a rebel within her own culture.
Sure. She really enjoyed the freedom she had there. I just realized I didn't say what kind of school she went to, but I imagine it was co-ed, or certainly there was mingling with boys in a way there never would have been in Pakistan. And she had friendships, she wore jeans. And again, you see some of that in the cities in Pakistan, but very little. But there, she could just kind of be who she wanted to be. And she got in trouble for that. And her family hauled her back to Pakistan and kind of clamped down. You know, even though she kept a job, they were determined to marry her off and have her be a proper Pakistani wife.
One of the refrains of the book is a saying that she learns from her sister, mm-hmm. which is, "You are stone, you are ice." What is the necessity of women developing this type of armor? And what is it in response to?
I think it's really important to have that defense against sort of the daily panoply of everything bad that happens to you. In every way, you're reminded you're a second-class citizen, that you don't matter, that you don't have ownership of your actions, that you can be punished horrifically for very slight misdeeds at any moment. You know, so you always have to be on guard. If you let yourself feel all of that, I think it would destroy you. And I think in some ways you have to build that exterior and that shell. And I think women in every culture do that to an extent.
That's right. At the end of the book, it acts as a bit of a contagion, and Leave adopts it mm-hmm. herself. Can you speak to why an American woman would need to become stone and ice?
I think everyday life tells you that. But again, certainly not. You know, we're so fortunate here in so many ways because largely, but not particularly, we don't worry that a misstep is going to get us killed, except we do worry about that. It drives me crazy that I'm always bugging my partner about this. Like, you never think twice walking down a street at night. It just is not a factor in your life. Whereas for us, you've got to be on guard, and it's smart to be on guard, and that makes me a little crazy. So I think in those ways it comes in, but largely we don't have to worry about it in the way women over there do. But we can identify very quickly. One of the things I loved about talking with women there is we really bonded over things like taking care of kids and being exhausted and having a job, and then you come home and your kids are like saying, "Feed me, talk to me, play with me. Can I just like sit down for a few minutes?" No. So there's that sort of universal thing that goes on between women. And then also the unspoken acknowledgement that there are threats and they're real.
That's right. One of the lines you write is, "In this world, a woman's very life could turn on whether a man had a bad day."
Yeah. And I think that's a true thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If a woman does something offensive, and things as little as a woman seen talking to a man, not her husband or not her relative, can really get you in trouble fast.
Tell me about the title.
The title is not my title. I have yet to have, I think, a single title I've chosen for one of my books make it through to the book. We went through many iterations. My original vision was that it would be called The Cooperative Husband. It was pointed out to me early on that men might not buy a book with that title. Silent Hearts was a shortened version of a longer title, and I thought it was just perfect. The fact that these women are silenced, that everything they bear, they have to bear behind that outer shell. Within, I think their hearts are pretty loud, but the smart way to be is to be quiet. And I think these days especially, you realize the penalty that silence takes. So I'm happy we ended up with this, even if it wasn't my idea.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Gwen Florio about her novel, Silent Hearts. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Gwen describes what it's like to report from places struck by tragedy, which Gwen is no stranger to. Along with traveling to post 9/11 Afghanistan, she was also one of the reporters on the scene after the Columbine school shooting.
This part of the interview contains material appropriate for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised.
You don't shy away from addressing sex as one of the platforms in which gender dynamics take place. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to write your way through these difficult sexual places?
Oh God, all I could think of was my mother's going to read this. There are a couple scenes, one in particular, that was incredibly difficult for me to write. In revising the book, I really skimmed over it. I mean, I have a hard time reading it today, but it felt very necessary. It's a pretty common experience over there. Yeah.
You've reported on the Columbine school shooting. Mm-hmm. What does reporting on violence do to your understanding of the human condition?
Wow. I think if I think about it too much, I would despair. Yeah. Columbine really, really affected me. And I remember thinking it was my second school shooting to cover. And at the time, I thought, oh my God, who has to do two of these? We also thought at the time, wow, it will never get worse than this. This is the most hideous thing I can imagine. Kids shooting each other. And it was really tough on me because I was living in Denver at the time. I had teenagers in high schools in the general Denver area, so it felt way too close to home. And again, there was just that sense, this is the worst story I will ever cover. There were times when I wanted to get out of journalism because of it. And then 9/11 happened, and Columbine felt like a little baby story by comparison. So you talk about it with other reporters who covered those things and you kind of swap experiences. I don't think other people understand unless they've been through it. And then our experience is just a tiny, tiny inkling of what the people directly involved go through. And I can't even imagine what that must be like.
As I was reading this book, I was thinking about what it must have been like to step into the shoes of the country. Mm-hmm. Facing, you know, America's attack and vice versa. How did you go about doing research to really fully inhabit that experience?
Again, just talking to people over there. One of the great things about writing a novel is all the stuff in your reporter's notebook that doesn't really fit in a story you can draw on to fashion the novel. Over and over again, two things impressed me. People were incredibly gracious. And that is part of the culture. You know, you invite a stranger in and you just start pouring tea. But it's also quite lovely. They were incredibly hospitable and incredibly welcoming, but said over and over again, you're not going to leave us again like you did before. You know, America isn't going to just pull out and abandon us again like they did once the Soviets left. And the only possible response to that was, I hope not.
What's the term you use for America in the book?
America, which is how they said it. So I just kind of, I hope I transliterated that correctly. Amriki for American. Yeah.
Can you speak more about what it meant then to adopt that term throughout the book?
I wanted, again, to give the sense that, you know, I was writing from the Pakistani and Afghani characters' point of view, and it just felt right to use that, to put that distance that they would feel from America and Americans.
Initially, when I read it, I felt like slightly alienated, and mm-hmm. then it had that effect where I was able to inhabit a different perspective, even though I was living through half of the book through the lives of Americans. And I know from personal experience traveling abroad, it's kind of refreshing to adopt the local language around who Americans are and how they exist in foreign places. One of the things you write from the perspective of Ghoul mm-hmm. is, I don't think they want to kill us themselves. That would make them look bad. I think they want to make us angry in small ways so that we fight among ourselves and kill each other. We'll do the job for them.
And isn't that something we do in these countries? We encourage the opposition groups, whoever we determine is on our side. We arm them. We send them off to fight sort of a proxy war. And I wanted his recognition of that.
The other interesting commentary I read, again from Ghoul, about killing foreigners is, you kill one of them, 20 will cry, especially if that one is not a soldier. They will yell about unfairness, but they will also become afraid. It does not take much to make them run and hide.
And I thought about after 9/11, as horrible as that was, I mean, it was just an unthinkable event. But then you go to other countries, you know, you go to Israel and the Palestinian areas, you go to any number of countries where bombings are just a regular occurrence, and people live with the possibility that they could die violently at any time. And that's what I was trying to convey.
As a perfect segue into another little piece I'd like you to read.
At this point in the book, Farida and Ghul are married, and they've basically started falling in love with each other at this point, which was not obviously the case when they were married, but they're getting used to each other. And they've just arrived in Jalalabad. 9/11 has happened. Ghul's family took the opportunity to leave Pakistan and go back to Afghanistan, where they're from. Farida slept in deep oblivion, savoring the warmth of her husband's body curled around her, his bare skin silky against her own. On this night, she'd whispered to him that the charade was real, that there would indeed be a baby. She smiled as she slid into her dreams. She woke screaming. The earth beneath them rumbled and shook. The walls swayed. Crockery fell and shattered in the kitchen. Voices rose, sounding more annoyed than frightened. The rumbling stopped. Then another crash, so loud the floor quivered. Farida shrieked again. She feared the ceiling would collapse. She curled into a ball, folding her knees against her belly. "Shh, it's all right." "Is it an earthquake? Shouldn't we go outside?" She tried to recall what she'd read about earthquakes, outside or under a doorway. She couldn't remember. She struggled from Ghul's grip, feeling about for her clothing. "Not an earthquake." His voice was tense, with an edge to it that reminded her of his father. "Then what?" "The Amriki have come. They're bombing us." Farida made as if to leap from the bed. Ghul restrained her. "Let me go." Her breath came fast. "Hurry, we've got to get out of here." "Inshallah, we'll be fine here." Even in her panic, Farida noticed the resignation in his tone. The house shuddered with a new explosion. "How are we fine?" "They're far away, in the mountains." "But it sounds as though they're next door." "Yes," said Ghul in that same flat manner. "That's how bombs sound."
When I read that line, I paused and thought, I am so lucky that I don't know what bombs sound like.
I know. I mean, and you realize that there are people who know exactly what they sound like, exactly what they have to sound like before they have to worry about them, before they have to take shelter. One of the things that struck me and that, frighteningly, I got very used to very quickly was that the minute it got dark over there, you started hearing gunfire. Bandits would come out, do whatever bandits do. But nighttime was when the shooting started. That was just the way it was. So, yeah, that was hard for me to get used to, but I wanted to convey the fact that for some people, again, that sense of violence is always present.
One of the things that I found curious about the book is there are places where violence goes unnamed, like a suicide bomb appears, but it's not actually named that.
Right.
And so I wanted to know your intention around leaving us to fill in the blank, knowing what we know as Americans.
Yeah, I wanted to just, again, give the sense that for the folks who were dealing with that, that was normalcy. It was just kind of routine. Okay, here we have a situation, and here's how we're going to deal with it, and here's what we have to do to deal with it. On with the day.
Ultimately, what's your hope for the book?
Oh, God, I hope it will do a couple of things. I hope it will familiarize people with a part of the world that we just get little tiny glimpses of. I hope that they'll realize that within Afghanistan, there are people trying to go about their lives, just trying to live like normal people, that they really would like to be able to get up and go to work and go to school in the morning and not worry about getting killed. I really want them to be concerned with women there. I mean, I was just, it made me a little crazy that women were so oppressed and that the international community seemed not to care.
Will this book be translated?
It's going to be translated into Turkish. The first foreign rights sold were to a Turkish publisher, which makes me really happy that it's to a Muslim country. That means I hope it means I got that right.
Yeah, that's amazing. And have you received any feedback from readers really familiar with the area?
I have, just sort of by happenstance. My web designer is Pakistani. speaks Urdu, read the book first, helped me with a couple of parts where I might have been a little shaky about something, but other than that, had no complaints. And that's something I was really, really concerned about, was wanting to get it right. When you're writing another culture, you want to tread very carefully. So I tried to write only about things I had directly observed, and then to follow up those things with a lot of research, again, to make sure I got it right.
And lastly, the book is dedicated to Scott and Razia. Who are they?
Okay, Scott's my partner, and he pointed out that we've been together 12 years now, and I was working on this book when I met him. And so he has been a cooperative husband.
I was wondering.
Yeah. He has supported me throughout this long, long, long journey on this book. And it's just been fabulous to have that kind of support, because it takes a ton of time away from him. Razia is a woman I met in Kabul. She was a widow with several children, and for some reason, her story affected me probably more than any other that I told. At one point, she put her children in an orphanage because she couldn't feed them, and when she went to get them out, her younger daughter wouldn't come home, because life in an orphanage was better than the life they had at home. I think about her all the time. My guess is that she is probably dead now. She was in her 30s when I met her. And at that time, life expectancy was very, very low. I think it was second lowest in the world. It was somewhere in your 40s for women. And so it's hard for me to think that. But I just, to an extent, I was thinking of her as I wrote a couple different women characters in this book.
Is there anything else you want us to know about the book?
I don't think so. I hope people read it and like it and learn from it.
Gwen Florio grew up in Delaware and moved west, eventually settling in Missoula, Montana, where she's an editor for the Missoulian newspaper. Her journalism has won several awards, as well as being nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She's also the author of the Lola Wicks mystery series. Silent Hearts is her first literary novel. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and you've been listening to The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.